Good morning, everyone. This is Brent with IHCA. Thank you all for joining us for this month's SNF provider update call. And thank you to everyone for adjusting your schedules. We rescheduled this to an hour later to accommodate the call that many of you were just on with IME regarding the changes to the QAF program. That is a topic that we will be focusing on at the top of this call here in just a minute. Before we get there, I want to have a special shout out to our sponsor for this month's call, Right Dose, a Guardian Pharmacy, longtime pharmacy partner with the Iowa Healthcare Association and helping us all bring this call to y'all today. So I'm going to hand this over to Brandon in just a moment. Today was a good day on the long road to economic stabilization. As many of you know, the association has developed a 5-point plan to achieve sector stability nearing the end of 2023. The first core component of that plan includes calls for an increase to the full 6% in the provider tax program. And we just heard about the plans to achieve that with an effective date of April 1st from the department earlier this morning. So we'll be talking a lot about that. The next step on the Medicaid funding path is the rebasing process. I suspect Brandon will talk a little bit about this when he references Day on the Hill in a few minutes on this call. But the budget process really sort of unofficially gets started here next week with the conclusion of what's called the first funnel deadline. That's this week. Every bill that does not have a fiscal note attached to it has to pass out of one committee in either the Iowa House or the Iowa Senate in order to remain alive by the end of this week. So very busy day at the Capitol. Maria Bentrot and our lobby team are down there right now working on a number of issues that we have in front of us. They're not appropriations related, but certainly we'll be working hard with all of you on the question of closing the remaining gap that remains after the increase in the provider tax here shortly. So with that, I'm going to go over to Brandon to talk you through not only what we now know officially when it comes to the increase in the provider tax, but some new IHCA resources that have just started to populate in your inbox and on our website. Brandon?
Yeah, thanks, Brent. So I'll just start by kind of going over some of the same information that most of you probably heard, but in case you were not able to attend the DHS call. There have been some changes to the Quality Assurance Assessment Fee program. And so really what this amounts to is about $117 million new dollars going to nursing facility providers, which is generated through this assessment fee program. Basically, fees are generated by providers paying in an assessment that those fees then being matched by the federal government and then returned in its entirety, all funds back to the nursing facility providers. And so a couple changes that needed to occur to be able to accommodate us moving from the previous 3.95% of revenue to now 6% of revenue is changes in the amount being paid in by providers. And so currently our non-waiver class pays $12.75. Effective April 1st, the non-waiver providers will now pay $33.90 per day. And so we also have our waiver class providers, which I'll go into those changes here in a second, but our waiver class providers currently pay $2.45. And that will be changing to $6.51. And so those waiver class providers is our group of providers who either are a CCRC as designated by the insurance division or have 46 or fewer licensed beds. And then the third category, which previously was set at 21,000 Medicaid days, has now been reduced to 19,000 Medicaid days. So a high Medicaid category of providers is also able to pay the lower tax or be a waiver class provider. And so those categories are determined and will hold as to what you currently are for the remainder of this state fiscal year. And so whatever you've been, what category you've been in for the last 9 months is the category that you will remain in on April 1st. Effective July 1st, you may be able to make changes to your provider class or your provider tax category using information that the department receives on June 1st of 23. So that's kind of the window in which you can make some of those changes. As far as timeline goes, there was a tribal and public notice that was issued on Friday, the 24th of February. That has to be in place for 30 days before the Department of Health and Human Services can submit a state plan amendment to CMS making these or requesting these changes to the QAF program. So 30 days from that notice period gets us to around the week of March 27th. So the week of March 27th, the department will submit the state plan amendment to CMS. And at that time, once that SPA is pending, which is pretty much right away, they are able to transmit rates then to the MCOs. They'll obviously have the rates, and then providers will be able to get those rate letters mailed to them around that week. They expect to post those rates on the week of April 3rd to their website. So if you pull your rates down from DHS's website, there's a spreadsheet out there. You can pull it from there, likely the week of April 3rd. What this does is this gets us with enough time for DHS and the MCOs to be able to get the rates into their system, because they can contractually have 30 days to get those rates in. And so that gets you to somewhere around that last week in April for them to contractually have those rates updated, which is okay, because you will not likely be submitting your May claims until that first week of May. So those rates should be implemented in the system already at that time for you to be able to bill and get reimbursed at your increased rate. And so one other addition to that is there's been guidance and discussion around the topic of usual and customary charges. And so while you should know your rate ahead of time prior to billing, it is good practice to bill at a usual and customary charge for all Medicaid days. And this is the reason being, managed care or any health plan typically reimburses providers using what they call lesser of logic. And so they will pay you the lesser of what is billed or what they're contractually obligated to pay you. And so in order for providers to make sure that we aren't essentially shooting ourselves in the foot and having to manually go in and have claims be reconsidered or reprocessed, we can bill at a charge that is in excess of what our rate is, knowing that the plan will pay you the lesser of billed versus contractual charges. And so if your contractual charges or your Medicaid rate in this case goes up, as long as it doesn't go above what you billed, they will be able to automatically reprocess at the new contractual amount. And so what you'll want to do is just make sure that, as standard practice, probably just set a rate, a standard rate, and Jeff here kind of likened it to the charges that you see on the back of a hotel door, which that's not actually the charge that you pay, but that's their posted rate. Something similar to that, that is far in excess of what you would actually be getting paid for the service. And so doing that allows you to be able to have claims reprocessed without needing to have to manually reprocess them yourselves. The MCOs would have the authority to then automatically reprocess because they have a billed charge that is in excess of their amount. And so, again, this is all happening effective April 1st. That is what I've just discussed is all related to the new tax structure and the new increased amounts that you'll be having to pay in. There's a second piece of this to where the funds that are received from the federal government are returned to providers through that process, and then the remaining funds are actually used to increase base rates for providers. And so there are funds remaining from this program that are returned through base rates. And what that does is that on average increases provider base rates by about 10.7%. And like Brent mentioned a little bit ago, and what you should have in your inbox now is written guidance from the association explaining the changes to the provider tax program or the quality assurance assessment fee program, but also a calculator for you to be able to determine by just keying in about five numbers, which consists of your average daily census by payer and your base rate. You can see how these changes will impact you as a provider. And so I know Lori was working on this, and I think she just posted it in the chat now for you. If you'd like to see or receive that guidance through our webpage, you can receive that information there. I think a piece that I forgot to mention was the add-on. So I talked about the tax increases going from 245 to 651, the pass-through going from 1275 to 3390. The most important piece is probably what the add-on is now. And currently the add-on is set at $15. The add-on in this new model will be moving up to $37. And so if you're thinking about your rate sheet, you have a base rate that is calculated using your costs and adjusted for case mix. You then get returned the add-on, which in this case is now $37 for all providers. And then you also have a return fee of the tax that you paid in from your Medicaid days. And so for your standard providers, that's going to be $33.90. For your waiver class providers, that's going to be $6.51. So base rate plus 37 plus whatever your tax rate is will be your new rate. And base rate in this case being increased by 10.7%. So I know that's a lot of information, and hopefully that the guidance that you've received in your inbox is helpful to you, as well as the calculator to actually determine the impacts that this has for you as a provider. But a few things that we want to just mention and clarify is just a reminder that obviously these tax rates are moving up significantly. And so as you are evaluating and receiving these funds, know that you are paid in advance and then needing to pay the state back. And so for April, May, and June, you will get paid at this increased rate. Then you have to pay it back on July 30th. And so just because of all these added dollars coming in, you will definitely want to either set aside like an escrow account or some kind of reserve, because the payback amount is going to be significantly higher than what you've been paying quarterly. A second note that we want to give and really caution providers on is a real sticking point with this program is that these costs cannot be passed through to private pay residents. And so the quality assurance assessment fee program cannot be a stated reason for any private pay rate increase. Doing so and that information getting back to the state could result in the removal of this program. And if you want to know what that means is you would then essentially just be paid at your base rate for Medicaid going forward if this program were to go away. Which would be, as we talked about earlier, I mean, just the increase in this program is $114 million. And so it would be, you know, far in excess of that as to total impacts of the program. So needless to say, we cannot hear about private pay rate increases using the quality assurance assessment fee as the reason for your private pay rate increase. Obviously, there are a multitude of reasons that you may need to increase your private pay rates. This cannot be one of those reasons. And so with that, I don't know that I have much more to add. I don't know. Jeff, I know you're on the call here too. Is there anything else that you would want to mention to members or any insights that maybe I have left out?
Thanks, Brandon. One of the things is in the handout or in the materials that are being made available, it talks about the timeline. And I think, you know, emphasizing that the calculator that we've created is for, you know, estimating what the rate increase. We're just 5 weeks away from knowing what the actual rate increase is. So those are just estimates. There are a couple other moving parts in primarily the case mix adjustment, which we don't know. And if you need that information, you can get it from IMPA. I would just want to emphasize, we did have a pretty good working relationship with the department on this in helping to put the finishing touches on getting this program started. And then I think that's it. You know, on the last item is just to emphasize again, many providers are going to have to consider what their private pay rates are compared to what their Medicaid rate is. And this is a significant increase. But again, we can't use the increase in the provider tax as one of the stated reasons for increasing our private rates. You know, there's a lot of movement in our base rate, a lot of movement in the overall rate, and it will also, it's likely there'll be another adjustment July 1, but using, Brandon said, I've said it now, it's like you cannot use the increase in the provider tax as a reason for increasing your private rates. That's all I have, Brandon.
Thanks, Jeff. I guess one thing that I also want to add here is while this is effective April 1 and provides some obvious and needed relief for providers, and this is just one part of our reimbursement strategy, the second part happening during rebase, and we'll get in here as we talk about Day on the Hill here in a little bit, but this is just part one of a two-part funding strategy to inject much-needed funds into the sector. I'll go to the next topic here, which is MCO onboarding. We would be in the process right now of onboarding the new MCO, Molina Healthcare. And so if you have the agenda, that also links to DHS's dedicated website to MCO onboarding. And so we are in a phase right now where members are being, actually, I think it starts tomorrow. Members are going to be reassigned to Molina. So I think obviously they're shooting for a third, a third, a third with each of the MCOs. Members who are reassigned or Medicaid recipients who will be reassigned will have up until May 18th to make an active change between if they want to go back to the original MCO or make a change, they can do that up until May 18th. I think they shut it off on May 18th because they need to have some kind of roster going into their go live on July 1. So that way they have an idea of number of members assigned to each plan. That does not mean that they are stuck with that MCO on May 18th, though. There is still an open choice period to where members can then change their MCO for 90 days after July 1 for any reason. And so while May 18th is a cutoff, initial cutoff, there is another 90-day deadline once go live happens that that Medicaid residents are able to change their MCO again. And so that link in the website or that link in the agenda is a good resource taking you to the onboarding website for additional information. We've also had bulletin articles on the topic as well. As far as a legislative update, we sent out a call to action earlier this week about the staffing mandate. And so While there is not a proposed rule currently in place or active on the staffing mandate, the efforts from AHCA and from all the state affiliates is to basically bombard CMS with letters trying to influence any proposed rule that the proposed rule that will come out regarding the staffing mandate. And so you would have received something from us earlier this week asking you to send comments to CMS using AHCA/NCAL's voter voice platform, which kind of it really lays out what the letter should look like, what you should maybe talk about. And then you can send it all right on that same platform. It's actually pretty slick. But really, they're trying to influence the staffing mandate rule, basically saying you want to set a standard. These people don't exist. It can't be unfunded. And so there's several points within that that those talkers on how to write your letter. We really would encourage members to participate and to submit those. I know you've seen a lot of call to actions from us over the last couple months. I promise they're all for great reasons. Obviously, we don't need a staffing mandate in place, especially when we don't have the workers. But a second call to action that we've had is sending your legislators your custom district impact reports. And why this is important is because we are starting and have started the rebase message with legislators for the last several months. But they also need to hear it from you in their own district as to how long-term care impacts their district specifically. And we have a custom report by each legislative district so they can see the number of facilities, basically payroll, number of employees, like total payroll, just to really gauge like, okay, so if I don't have a building in my district anymore, that's going to really knock down on the number of jobs that are currently being in my district. And so there's a call to action out on that right now as well, asking you to send that district impact report to your legislator. We are getting into budget talk time here shortly with first funnel occurring now. And so it's important to start to have that message and create that relationship with your legislator now, making sure that when they go into budget talks and they start hearing about rebase numbers floating around for nursing facilities, that they can have recollection to say, oh yeah, I did hear from my member or my constituent about that, and this is a real problem for them. And so another way that we're going to be pushing through that message is through the IHCA Day on the Hill and Grassroots Boot Camp. That is on March 8th. We will be taking about 125 members down to the Capitol to advocate for funding, mostly funding, members of all sectors, but it's predominantly our SNF operators asking for rebase funding. And so those conversations really start to heat up right around that March 8th time and throughout the month of March as they're trying to determine which providers they should be appropriating funding to and which ones they shouldn't. And so we will be having a boot camp that morning to really go through legislative makeup, the legislative priorities, and really arming our members with talking points and ways to have a conversation with your legislator to have the most impact and really get the most out of that conversation and be able to express the need for additional funding. And so we're really, really amped to have that many people coming down with us. And we're looking forward to having those conversations to really express how dire the situation is and how the need for funding is so important. I would also like to plug keepltclocal.com, which is our advocacy campaign website. And so if you haven't been on there, I would definitely take a look at that to really see the situation for nursing facility operators right now within the state. And we've been using that with much of our geofencing campaign and all that throughout the state for the duration of session so far. Where you can get additional information on session is in our Fridays from the State House call. We have those every week on Friday at 10 o'clock. That is where you can get a rundown of the most recent happenings for that week at the Capitol. And so we'd like to keep those calls pretty brief. They're usually around 20 minutes. You can get a synopsis of what's been happening, where we stand on issues, and the latest on any funding. So we definitely encourage you to take a look at that. It's an opportunity for you to hear what's been happening. And that is then recorded and placed in the bulletin the following week for anyone who'd like to listen to that. I think that covers most of the reimbursement and legislative update topics here. I'll turn it to Lori. I know that was a lot of information. So if you have any questions, feel free to put those in the chat. We can get to those at the end of the call. But I'll turn to Lori now for workforce.
Thanks, Brandon. What I have is kind of a reimbursement update as well. I was going to provide you an update today on our long-term care and infection control workforce grant that we have open right now. This is an $11.2 million grant that opened up for Iowa nursing facilities back in October. All eligible providers received an eligibility letter with the amount of the grant that you are eligible for, along with application instructions. So far, since the grant has opened, we've had 165 providers submit applications, and we've been able to issue over $1.3 million in checks to providers through this grant. So we're really, really happy about those results so far. This grant, if you have not applied yet, it will remain open for application until March 15th of 2024. So there is still time to apply. If you have already applied, I also wanted to provide you with a quick update on the status of our application reviews. The first round of applications that we reviewed, if you applied by November 15th, you were notified of your application results by January 13th. And checks were sent to those who met the eligibility requirements on February 8th. We mailed out actually over $960,000 just in that first round alone. If you applied by December 15th, you should have been notified of your results via email by February 7th. And checks for that round were sent on February 21st. And for that round, we sent about $307,000 in checks out. If you apply by January 15th, we anticipate getting notification results to you out by the end of this week or early next, and checks for that round will be issued by the end of March. And if you applied by February 15th, your application is currently under review, and we anticipate sending out notifications and checks for that round by the end of April. And again, just want to remind everyone, you have until March 15th of 2024 to apply, and we'll continue to pull applications and review them every month. If you need any help with submitting an application, I'd encourage you to check out our guidelines on the grant application website, and I can pop a link of that into the chat for everyone as well. That website is ltcworkforcegrant.iowa.gov, and you can find everything there you need to know about how to apply and what the guidelines are for applying. If you do not have a copy of your eligibility letter or need a copy of that letter, or have any questions, you can also email ltcworkforcegrant@iowahealthcare.org, and we're happy to help with any questions there. So that concludes my update, and I think now I turn it over to Brenda for the next update.
Thanks, Lori, and I think I am going to take them through the rest of the agenda. So the first item of business is on the regulatory front. As you all know, CMS has taken a specific interest in the use of antipsychotics in our industry, and specifically the diagnosis of schizophrenia. So I just wanted to share with you all some MDS coding information to help make sure that you are coding that diagnosis correct when you're submitting those MDSs. So the REI manual does state that any active diagnosis for a resident should be coded on the MDS, and it clearly states that it's within the last 7 days, and that it should be physician documented, and that it should have a clear and direct relationship to the care that you're providing to that resident. So one would think that if a person is receiving an antipsychotic, and the physician has diagnosed them with schizophrenia, that schizophrenia would then naturally be included in the list of diagnoses in the MDS. So I would like to draw your attention to a specific example that is given in the REI manual about a resident that was admitted without the diagnosis of schizophrenia. And I think this probably occurs fairly often in our neck of the woods, but the resident is admitted without the diagnosis of schizophrenia. After their admission, they exhibit some behaviors, are diagnosed or are prescribed an antipsychotic with the diagnosis of schizophrenia, likely from their primary care provider. And the REI manual goes on to explain that that diagnosis of schizophrenia should not be coded on the MDS because the physician evaluation that is attached to that diagnosis does not meet the requirements. So the requirements for justifying or sustaining that particular diagnosis would include a psychiatric evaluation by a qualified practitioner. So if you find yourself thinking about that, you'll think that I'm going to have someone who is prescribed an antipsychotic without a justifiable diagnosis. And you'll want to consider if that diagnosis is appropriate, how you may go on and get a psychiatric evaluation to verify that. So if in your agenda, there is a link to that MDS coding, those instructions. So please take a look at that, share that with your MDS coordinators, your nurse managers, and even your physicians so that they understand that coding mechanism. We've talked about this a couple of times, but I definitely encourage you to identify any residents in your facility that have that diagnosis coded on their MDS. As CMS has begun their offsite audits, and they are asking facilities to provide them with justification for those diagnoses and the use of those medications in their facilities. So if you're encountering any of those audits and you wish to have some help with that, please let me know. I have not heard of any in Iowa. That does not mean that they're not occurring, but I know that they are happening across the nation. So just want to make sure that we're being compliant with that requirement. So COVID-19 news, end of the federal public health emergency is upon us. It has been announced by the Biden administration that May 11th will be the last day of the federal public health emergency. So with that, many things will be changing for our industry. So we have created a document that is a guide for our members to help you understand what will be happening to some specific items or waivers that have been in effect throughout most of the COVID pandemic. So there are a few items on there that I want to talk about briefly. Specifically the 3-day hospitalization waiver. I get quite a few questions about that, about what is going to happen to that. Is it going to be extended? And what we know right now is that they do anticipate to end that waiver on May 11th. So a couple of nuanced things that I wanted to share with you is that if you do have a resident that is in your building, Medicare Part A payer, that is in a skilled stay that was admitted to your facility under that waiver, if they are in your facility receiving care on May 11th, they can continue to receive care uninterrupted. You don't need to make any changes to their care or anything else. You can carry on as if nothing has changed. However, starting May 12th, anyone that is admitted into your facility under a skilled level of care with a Medicare Part A payer will need to have that 3-day hospitalization. There were lots of questions about what's going to happen to telehealth. And there, obviously there was a waiver that has been in place throughout the federal public health emergency attached to the 1135 CMS blanket waiver that allowed telehealth to occur. That waiver is actually going to end with the end of the federal public health emergency. However, back in December, late December, the federal government approved telehealth to continue through the end of 2024. So you will still be able to provide telehealth services to your residents through the end of next year. One caveat to that, a word of warning, is that I want to remind you that the waiver specific to required physician visits in skilled nursing facilities did end in May of last year. So any of those required visits, so the 30, 60, 90 day visits, they are required to be provided in person. So a couple of the new things that were put into place during the pandemic, I know there's lots of questions about will they continue, will they end? And so I want to share with you what I know at this point. So there is, you know, the required NHSN reporting that's been in effect for quite some time now. And this is specifically the pathways reporting, where you're reporting aggregate information about your facility in terms of the number of positive tests that you've had or the number of deaths that you've had. That will continue until the end of next year. So at this point, we can expect that to continue until that time. So I want to be, I know this is going to get a little bit complicated, but the reporting of specific resident or staff positive results, so meaning if a person tests positive, you have been required under the state mandatory reporting order to report those positive test results. Many of us were doing that through REDCap in the beginning and then transitioned to do that through the NHSN point of care reporting tool at some point in time when that became available. So with you likely received a notice from the state of Iowa saying that the mandatory reporting order was going to be ending on April 1st. What I am not sure, what is unclear at this point, is whether or not we will continue under the federal rule to report those positive tests, because there is a CLIA requirement from CMS that does still require that. So more to come on that. As we learn more, we'll share more. But at this point in time, it's unclear about whether or not after April 1st, you will need to continue reporting those positive tests through NHSN. I know many of you are wondering about testing supplies that have been coming from the HHS services throughout the pandemic. I know many of you have reached out to me to say that the supplies are tapering off, they're intermittent. We still have not received any definite word from the feds about whether or not that program will continue. I think it's fair to say that we can expect it to end at some point in relation to the end of the federal public health emergency. One other thing that I know you're all wondering about is the CDC's COVID data tracker and how that may change with the changing in reporting requirements. And that is also something that is unclear at this point. I know that I've been having some conversation with Iowa HHS, with Dr. Hennefant, with DIA, and also our national affiliate to understand that relationship and how that reporting will change what we see on the COVID data tracker that, of course, determines our actions in terms of PPE use in our facilities. So have yet to receive an answer on that, but certainly we'll share that with you when it comes. But please take a look at that end of the federal public health emergency document. There are many other items of guidance included in that other than the ones that I've just shared with you. So on to quality improvement, would like to just draw your attention to the top line reports that were made available in long-term care trend tracker last month, or at the beginning of the month, rather. These top line reports are specifically valuable this time because they shared some facility specific information regarding how your facility may need to change your staffing patterns when or if the staffing mandate is written as it's anticipated at this point. Certainly, this is a best guess by the trend tracker folks at ACA because we don't know yet what the requirement will be, but we have a fairly educated guess. And there's some guidance in there that's very specific to your facility and your PVJ reported staffing data to help you understand what you may need to do differently and how you sit in relationship to that expected standard. So as Brandon mentioned earlier, that call to action to CMS about the staffing mandate, that information may be particularly helpful to you if you're submitting a comment letter to CMS about the staffing requirement. So wanted to draw your attention to that. The governor's award is open for nominations. DIA published at the end of January that they were opening the portal for nominations for nursing facilities and other types of providers in the state for the quality of care awards. So that particular portal is open until May 24th. If you click on the link in your agenda, you can it'll take you directly to that page where there is a downloadable or printable nomination form that you can share with residents and families to help them get the word back to DIA about the quality of care that you're providing in your facility. So again, deadline on that, March 24th. If you don't have an agenda, you can go to the DIA Health Facilities website, and it's right there on their homepage. If you scroll down about half the way, there's a box there that will take you to that governor's award nomination section. Also wanted to extend an invitation to you all to join us in Grapevine, Texas on May 22nd through the 24th for the Quality Summit. Looks like there's a great lineup of all sorts of quality related education that will be provided to attendees for those days. It's a Monday through Wednesday. So would invite you to take the opportunity to join us there. So for education, upcoming educations, just wanted to share with you that we have an ICD-10 coding essentials for skilled nursing facilities on March 14th. This is an education that's geared toward administrators, nurse managers, and MDS coordinators. It is provided virtually, so you can log in via Zoom and participate in that education. And it's also recommended that you have an updated copy of the ICD-10 coding manual to better understand. They're going to walk you through how to use that manual. It's quite complicated if you've never done that before. But understand how to use that coding mechanism to increase your reimbursements in your facility and make sure there's accuracy. So invite you to take a look at that. At March 21st, we're having an MDS 3.0 update. This will be an in-person education here at our education center in West Des Moines, where we will be sharing what we know at this point about the upcoming MDS changes that we anticipate for October of this year. So a little bit of word about that. We have yet to see an updated REI manual be released by CMS. And in addition to that, there are some case mix formulations that we're unsure exactly how the state will be utilizing those MDS changes to change that formula in the state. But we will be sharing what we do know during that particular session. So invite you to join us that day. At the end of March, the 28th and the 29th, we'll be having our spring quarterly education. So I liken this to a mini convention in the spring. It's our lineup is jam-packed with reimbursement, regulatory, quality improvement, all sorts of really valuable education for you to join in and learn from. At that conference. It's going to be held in Des Moines downtown at the Hilton Hotel, which is the new hotel that is attached or adjacent to the Iowa Event Center. So we welcome you to join us to that. In April, we're having a three-day event called Foundations for Wound Care. And so this event is for nurses and nurse managers to join and learn about the specifics of wound assessment and documentation and care planning provided to us by Wound Care Plus. So it'll be the same education provided 3 days in a row in three different locations. The first one, April 11th, will be in Coralville, and then April 12th here in West Des Moines at our office, and on April 13th in Carroll. So feel free to invite any of your nurses or other staff that assist with wound care assessment and care planning to those events. Last week, we had our virtual life safety, fire safety training course. It was a two half-day training that has now been recorded and placed on our on-demand platform. So if you missed it last week, you don't need to worry. You can still access that training. Or if you did participate and got pulled away and missed something, you're welcome to go into the on-demand platform and listen to the information that was provided there from our local fire marshal and other life safety, fire safety experts. So I think with that, I'm going to go to Brandon for questions.
All right. Thanks, Brenda. We have a few in the chat here. I've tried to answer a couple that have come directly to me, so you should have received a message back. But what's in the chat here is, with the pandemic ending, any news on not reporting to NHSN weekly?
So the NHSN reporting will continue through the end of 2024. And what I'm talking about is the pathways reporting. I have not heard any change to the COVID vaccine reporting, so I would anticipate that to continue until we hear more from CMS. The only thing that I believe may be changing is that specific point of care testing positive reporting requirement. So more to come on that, but NHSN will continue at least until the end of next year unless we hear otherwise.
I think this is probably more of a comment, but got an email that we don't need to report positives to public health anymore after March 31st, but curious about NHSN reporting as well. So I don't know.
I want to just maybe provide some clarification. There is a CLIA requirement at the federal level. So remember that all nursing facilities essentially are operating under a CLIA waiver, which is a laboratory waiver that allows you to complete those COVID tests. That particular CLIA rule does require the reporting of positive results. I do not believe that there is an end date to that specific requirement. I think with all of the changes that are occurring with the end of the PHE, we can anticipate that that may change, but we're not sure, and I have not received any verification that that will occur. So really unclear at this point whether or not we will need to continue doing that.
I got a couple questions on the three-day SNF waiver ending.
Yeah, so the waiver will be in place until May 11th, which is the last day of the federal public health emergency. Starting May 12th, will be the first day that skilled nursing facilities cannot admit someone skilled unless they have that three-day stay.
And then anyone who is on an active skilled stay prior to May 11th or May 12th, that's okay. They can continue on as normal for the entirety of that skilled stay. Is that correct?
That's correct. And just for additional clarification, this does only apply to Medicare Part A specific payers. If you have someone under a Medicare Advantage program, they are able to write their own rules. And I know many of them have already done that in as how they're handling the three-day stay waiver. So any of those Advantage plans are able to dictate that as they see fit for their plan. So that three-day stay is specific to a Medicare Part A traditional payer.
And we are aware of efforts trying to extend that. I know we can't plan on that right now, and we'll continue marching ahead with that May 11th date of the public health emergency ending, but there is work to try to extend that into perpetuity. So,
yeah. Yes, there is.
I do have one other question of when was the date of the MDS education in Des Moines?
Oh, the MDS 3.0 update is on March 21st here at the office in West Des Moines.
Awesome. Cool. That is what I have for questions. I know, Brenda, you want to do a survey update, so I will stop our recording here.